The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 27th of March 2020 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up:
the government will pay self-employed people who have been adversely affected by the coronavirus a taxable grant worth 80% of their average monthly profits over the last 3 years, up to £2,500 a month.
Too little, too late. Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé and Bloomberg's Ed Robinson discuss the sluggish economic response to the pandemic. Plus, the former Downing Street insider Lance Price will have the latest as the UK's Prime Minister Boris Johnson tests positive for COVID-19. Monocle's contributing editor Andrew Muller also offers his take on another extraordinary week in news. And then...
Hello, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco and I'm back with the Global Countdown. This time, I look at the top 5 singles in Italy.
Our pop countdown shows solidarity with one of the countries which has been hardest hit by the COVID-19 outbreak. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Markus Hippi. There have been rarely busier weeks to be working in a global newsroom. Even in the past hour, it's been revealed that the UK's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has tested positive for COVID-19. Such fast-moving events mean that journalists and broadcasters have had to adapt at breakneck speed to keep readers and listeners updated with events that are unfolding around them. But there has been considerable criticism that many governments haven't done the same, which has left small and medium-sized businesses and their employees in limbo. I'm joined for more on this by Ed Robinson, who is a senior writer at Bloomberg, and Tyler Brulé, Monocle's editor-in-chief, who joins me on the line from Monocle 24's studio in Zurich. Welcome to the programme. Tyler, if I may start with you, why do you think some governments have been so slow to act? Have they been simply caught out?
Hello, Markus. I think that some governments would say they've been very quick to act. I think the bigger issue is, did they have everything completely joined up in the background? And what we're seeing is the answer is absolutely no. I know this is not across the board. I think that some countries have had a reasonably cohesive scheme. They were out in front of the microphones, the cameras. They're, of course, out in front of their populations in certainly decent speed. And we've also seen a downflow of money as well. And we've been talking about the situation in Switzerland. We've been talking a little bit about Germany as well, though there are some question marks there. Is money, you know, reaching Germany's Mittelstand fast enough? But I think that's the main issue. You probably go and talk to a lot of advisors in government. They would say, Markus, no, look, we've done everything we could. We were right out there as much as we were talking about all things that have to be done medically. You know, we have been there. But I think we've seen there's a massive, massive lag by the time it gets down to local branches.
Ed, there has been considerable criticism of the UK's rescue plan, for example. What do you think has gone wrong?
Well, the rescue plan is built on similar plans that were enacted after the 08-09 crash. So there's a sense on the part of small business trade groups and advisors who work in that space that the government may be fighting the last war. And more specifically, when it comes to the business loan guarantee program, which is designed to provide a stopgap or a safety net for small and medium-sized businesses, they structured it in such a way where 80%, there'd be an 80% guarantee to the bank for loans that they extend to companies, and then the banks would be on the hook for the other 20%. And while at first glance that looks sensible, the problem is that by putting the banks on the hook for 20%, it activates all of that old and traditional underwriting processes. And as we know, getting a business loan from a bank takes a long time. And companies right now, they're watching their revenue go to zero. They don't have time. So there's a number of critics who thought maybe the government should have guaranteed 100% of the loan. That would have simplified the application process. You wouldn't have had to ask for security and collateral and all of those usual elements in a loan, and the money would have hit the street faster.
Now, Tyler, obviously you are joining us from Zurich. Could you share us some insights? How has the UK government's response, how has it been viewed on the continent?
Well, I think putting it in perspective, Mark, as Ed hits it on the head. I mean, one thing that the Swiss government has done, and we've dipped in on this a couple of times this week, they've said to small enterprises, $500,000 Swiss francs, roughly $500,000 US dollars. It's 100% backed by the Swiss government. You go to your bank, you have a conversation with them. Of course, they do have to look at the books a little bit, but hopefully you have a good relationship with your bank, and then you have up to 5 to 7 years 0% interest, which is quite something, and then. Beyond that, it's probably, and this is the critical point that Ed makes, it's in your account that day. And this is what really needs to be done and delivered. So I think, yeah, whether you talk to lots of other business leaders and people even with some of the banks, they're a little bit, I would say, flabbergasted by this approach in the UK, knowing, of course, that so much of the UK is also so over-leveraged as it is anyway. So I think, you know, there's two sides. I think the banks, you know, are not looking great in the UK at the moment, at least from this side of the continent. I think also, we were chatting about this a bit earlier, also landlords as well. You know, another part, again, super over-leveraged and probably not cutting the types of deals for businesses that are not bringing anything. Empty shops, empty restaurants, empty services up and down the high street. And yet we're hearing, of course, that you know, many are just saying, you need to go and pay your rent. That's what we're expecting. That's what we need from you.
Now, Ed, what would you say to that? What are the most crucial aspects? What would need to be done in the UK, for example, to help companies to access cash?
Well, immediately, they've got to get the loans out to them on terms that are attractive to the businesses. So what's happened is there's 40 accredited lenders, and those include the big banks like HSBC, Barclays, RBS, all the way down to smaller community-based banks. And those lenders are able to design all of their own underwriting rules under this program. So if you're a small business, you're looking at this panoply of different options. You're going to go with your traditional lender because that's who you have a relationship with. But all of that adds a lot of complexity to the process. I mean, the description that Tyler put out about what's happening in Switzerland, I think it's very similar to what France is doing as well, would be an absolute tonic for companies here. You know, it's just simple. You don't have to worry about interest. You don't have to worry about security. And you know you're going to get the money quickly. And so I think the government, you know, it may be, there may be some effort to try and get the government to go back to the drawing board and say, you need to rejigger this plan after a week of criticism and maybe simplify it a bit. And, you know, that we'll see if government does that.
Tyler, things are a bit different in Zurich, and obviously the coronavirus outbreak began there earlier. What do you think are the most important aspects to learn from all this? For example, when you look at how banks and decision makers are trying to help firms who are struggling, and also how companies are adapting their practices.
Sure. Well, I think if we start on adapting practices, I think one thing which Ed brings up, which is really important, you know, if the UK has to go back to the drawing board, which it may very well, you know, I almost see it as there's no other way to go. They're going to have to address this, but this takes more time. And we're at the end of the month. We are at the end of Q1. So that means, of course, a lot of businesses have to be paying their rent a quarter in advance. So that's a problem right there. So I think you're going to see a lot of this really coming home to roost in terms of really just whether it's voices on the street, hopefully, you know, safely social distanced apart. But I think that, you know, the wheels are going to come off this, I think, next week in the UK, because it's simply not moving fast enough. To the first part of your question, Marcus, in terms of maybe lessons learned, and where can we, you know, maybe for next time around, you know, try to find some essential learnings. I think it's just clear communications. And I think it means also that you can have a chancellor, you can have a minister go and stand up in front of the media and of course the nation. But if those conversations have not happened with the CEOs of the banks right away, but not even just the CEOs of the banks, really the middle management, the people who have to get out there, the people who have to be executing, because they know that then the branch managers and people further down the chain are going to be coming in the next day asking questions. That has to be completely, you know, stitched up right away. And I think that's been a significant failing in the UK, not just the UK. We've seen this in other countries as well. And then there's some strong learnings. I said a few grumblings in Germany at the moment. Germany will fix it. France seemed to have it certainly fixed. You know, a very confident message, one you can't go back on from President Macron. And certainly we're impressed by what we see here in Switzerland as well.
Tyler, I know that you've been having quite interesting discussions over there recently, and there is one discussion we actually recorded.
Yeah, indeed. Yesterday, Marcus, we were talking in Zurich to some neighbors not very far away, rather a large company of scale, Fortune 500 company. We were speaking to Alain Diaz. He's the CEO of Adecco. And of course, people are very familiar with the Adecco name. They're the biggest player in human resources, or one of the biggest players in human resources in the world. And of course, when it comes to temporary staffing, real leaders as well. And anyway, I started by asking him about the role that coronavirus has had on the workforce, the changes as well that he thinks are being brought about. There's been a lot of discussion right now, of course, leading into this. You know, we've been talking about remote working and, of course, how is the changing workplace evolving, etc. And we're almost in a period now, it's almost like be careful what we once upon a time wished for. And we thought that the future was going to look great because everyone could be at home and everyone could be on digital platforms. But we've seen so many different things unfold. The people who you would have thought really would crave to be at home, actually, they want to be in the office right now. Other people, of course, are maybe, you know, for health reasons, are scared to be in there. Do you think that we actually return to a state of normalcy after this, that there will be a settle down? Or is this really marked a fundamental, you know, turning point? Technology has revealed that we don't all need to be in the same place. Maybe we don't need to, of course, have desks across from each other. So many companies have tried to push people to hot desk and do different ways of working. And of course, we know there's mental health issues, and maybe we can come back to that a little bit later. But has this marked a watershed moment in terms of the way we work?
I think that there will be a pre-pandemic and a post-pandemic way of work. And if working from home was pre-pandemic a kind of benefit people were entitled to and very happy to use, today it is a necessity because we have to. And I'm not sure if tomorrow will be a benefit, a necessity, or a flexible tool. Because yes, some people have very good conditions to work at home, but for some others, it's very difficult. It's extremely difficult to take calls the whole day with doing homeschooling and home working at the same time. So I think that there are many people in the world today who are very happy at the perspective to come back at the office today.
And if we look at that sort of, let's say, the short-term play, the mid-term play in terms of what's going to stick, you know, do you think that there are really sort of certain things that, yeah, as people look at their 2021, 2022 budgets, do you think we see a lot of CEOs say, you know what, we're going to get rid of 20% of our floor space suddenly because actually some of this homeworking, actually, that worked okay. Do we see other companies, you know, potentially looking at, yeah, we're going to go more freelance. We just realize we don't need as many fixed workers. And maybe the third part, are just some things also now off the table? Has this also really shown in what will become hopefully a post-pandemic world that actually some of these measures that we thought were interesting, they were nice little experiments, forget it. You know, we need to get back to this.
It's a little bit early to tell what the world will be. We are 3-4 weeks in this era. So in many countries, we are still at the beginning and we have not reached the peak. So one country to be looked at will be China, to see how they are going out of this crisis and what they are doing. I think it won't be black and white. It won't be, let's go now 100% digital, because we have been 100% digital during a few weeks, few months during the crisis. I think we will come back to a kind of mix where, for sure, digitization will have accelerated and will continue to accelerate. But on the other side, you know, the social contact are very important. So there are many cases of isolation. And how do you make sure that work still fulfill one of the biggest value of it, which is social integration? And by being just alone in a room somewhere in the world, you don't work to your social integration. You need physical contact. And I think it will be a kind of new balance between the two, taking the advantage of digitalization, but continuing to play out this physical presence to realize the social integration.
And that was Alain Daz, CEO of the Adecco Group, talking to us here in Zurich yesterday. And Marcus, for people who want to hear more of that, they can tune in next week for the continuation of our series, The Way to Work. It's going to premiere here on Monocle 24 next week.
That sounds very good. Just finally, Tyler, before we let you go, do you think decision makers have learned lessons from this virus outbreak? And I guess companies alike, will they be in a better position to respond if something like this happens in the near future again?
Well, of course, Marcus, we have that saying, you know, some people never learn. And I'm sure that there will be many that go back to their usual ways, maybe not right away. There's going to be a transition period, but it just feels more comfortable. It's inevitable that people come back into the workplace. And it feels just like the way it did in a very normal way back in January or back in November of 2019. So you can see some old habits sticking. But I do think that, we're in for something pretty transformational. I mean, companies that are sharp, who've been paying attention and have really had to respond, and of course, I think many have, I think will certainly step up to the plate. But, you know, I can also see many others. We were just talking about the banks a little bit earlier. They're behaving exactly as Ed from Bloomberg was saying earlier. They're fighting an old war and using a completely different, set of tactics and old tactics, even worse.
That was Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé joining us from Zurich. Thank you very much. And before that, we heard from Ed Robinson, a senior writer at Bloomberg. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. As we were alluding to at the top of the programme, it's been a pretty up and down week for Europe's top leaders. While some, like the UK's Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who was just tested positive for COVID-19, have certainly struggled, France's Emmanuel Macron and Germany's Angela Merkel have shown real leadership and risen to the challenges. Let's get more on this now with Lance Price, who served as Tony Blair's Director of Communications when he was Prime Minister. First off, Lance, Boris Johnson has just tested positive for COVID-19. What does this mean in practice now? What practical impact does this have on the running of government?
Well, I think if his symptoms remain mild, which is what he tells us they are, and of course he's put out a video on Twitter so we can see that he doesn't appear to be too seriously ill, I don't think it has a dramatic effect. Boris Johnson says that he's going to continue to lead the British government's response to the virus and that he's self-isolating at home. And of course, it's an advantage that for the British Prime Minister, home and office are indeed in the same building, because he is self-isolating in a flat actually above 11 Downing Street, but the two buildings are joined together. So I think everyone should wish him well. And of course, we have to remember that his girlfriend is pregnant, and that pregnant women are advised to take particular care at this time. So on a personal level, it's difficult for them. On a practical level, I think that government will go on pretty much as before. But having worked inside Downing Street, I can tell you that there's a lot of very small rooms, quite narrow corridors. Every time the Prime Minister goes in and out of that famous front door, there's a guy behind the door or a woman behind the door letting him in. It's very hard to keep a 2 meter distance from people. So I think a lot of people, he's almost certain, I'd be amazed whether he's been able to keep, just physically possible for him to keep, a 2 meter distance from all of his staff over recent days.
Boris Johnson certainly hasn't had the best week. In other news, there are suggestions that he has difficulties in telling people what to do.
Well, I think he has done his best to rise to the situation. He came at it with disadvantages. One of the disadvantages was that he was seen to be a little bit of a clown for a politician, not to be too brutal about it, and has had a tendency in the past to sort of laugh things off and try to shrug off difficulties. I think actually his performance in front of the cameras has been pretty good since the crisis developed. But I'm sure that in the fullness of time, when we look back on this, and there will be inquiries into what happened and when decisions were made, there will be some serious questions for the Prime Minister to answer. Some of those are being raised on Question Time, for example, on the BBC last night. The editor of The Lancet, one of the principal medical scientific magazines, really calling into question the slowness of the government's response, both in terms of getting the equipment to the front line and the health service that was necessary, and also, of course, those vital tests. So there are already, and there will be more, very difficult questions for Boris Johnson and his ministers and advisers to answer.
At the same time, his Chancellor Rishi Sunak seems like a natural in this crisis. Have you been impressed with him?
Yes, I think for a relatively young man, I don't think he's even 40 yet, and very new to the top rank of politics. He has shown great communication skills, of course, which is what my responsibility used to be, and you can't fault him on that. And he does seem to be showing a very good judgment. So, you know, these guys are still politicians, and while they are working together as a team, there is no doubt that, again, in the fullness of time, we will look back and see who was performing better than others. And I do think that Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, is almost certain to come out of this with his reputation greatly enhanced.
Well, let's look at the continent now. What is your take on how Germany's Angela Merkel has handled this difficult situation?
I think she has decades of experience, and she is a very calm head in a crisis. So I think that actually, Germany at the moment appears to have quite a lot to be thankful for, but the fact that Angela Merkel is still there as Chancellor is one of those things. And also, of course, for such a large country, they do seem, for reasons that not everybody yet fully understands, to have had less of an impact from the virus than other comparable countries, other large countries, including the United Kingdom.
Another leader in Europe who's been praised for his leadership is Francis Emmanuel Macron. Could you just try to summarise why it seems that both Macron and Merkel have been able to communicate with the public far better than Boris Johnson has managed to do? At least that's how it seems.
I think there was less ambiguity in their messaging. That's certainly true of Macron, who was very clear, very firm, and very strict with the French public. So whereas Boris Johnson appeared reluctant to tell British people that they had to stay indoors, that they shouldn't go to work, that they should be self-isolating, and all the rest of it, Macron had no such inhibitions. He was out there with very strict rules about movement and putting the police on the streets to enforce those rules, having fines in place, all of that much, much faster and without any, as I say, any of the inhibitions that the British government appeared to show. Now, there are different attitudes. Different countries have a different relationship between the people and their governments, and I think that is significant. In the United Kingdom, we don't like being told what to do by the government. We don't even have national ID cards, which a lot of people in other countries find extraordinary. And a lot of the opposition to national ID cards came from within the now governing Conservative party. Whereas in France, they do have national ID cards. They're used to being told what to do by the government. And although they can be pretty stroppy about it sometimes, they are willing to accept that authority. And therefore, Emmanuel Macron's been able to play it that way.
Lance Price, thank you very much for your insights. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. After a short break, we'll recap what we've learned in the past 7 days.
The Entrepreneurs has undergone a bit of a makeover, and we want you, our listeners, to get involved. It's a strange time to be a small business owner, and so we are giving you the opportunity to ask questions to industry leaders, from retailers to CEOs to creatives. Find out about taking your startup to the next level. Maybe you want to know more about how to move a fashion company online. Perhaps you're uncertain about funding. Whatever's playing on your mind, email us at question@monocle.com and we'll get our experts on it. Tune in to The Entrepreneurs every Wednesday at 20:00 London time or subscribe at Apple Podcasts. The Entrepreneurs, in association with UBS.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Briefing with me, Markus Hippi. It's time now for our assessment of the past 7 days. Here is Monocle's contributing editor, Andrew Müller, on what has been quite a week.
We learned this week, or at least continued to learn the hard way, that the United States' decision in 2016 to elect to Earth's most powerful office a half-witted real estate grifter-turned-game show host may have been, on somber reflection, ill-advised. This was President Donald Trump as recently as a month ago.
We have the best prepared people, the best people in the world. Congress is willing to give us much more than we're even asking for. That's nice for a change.
And this was President Benito Cartman this week, lowering spectacularly to the challenge of making a global health emergency all about himself.
I think there are certain people that would like it not to open so quickly. I think there are certain people that would like it to do financially poorly because they think that would be very good as far as defeating me at the polls. And I don't know if that's so, but I do think it's so that that there are people in your profession that would like that to happen. I think it's very clear. I think it's very clear that there are people in your profession that write fake news. You do. She does. There are people in your profession that write fake news. They would love to see me for whatever reason, because we've done one hell of a job. Nobody's done the job that we've done. And it's lucky that you have this group here right now for this problem, or you wouldn't even have a country left, okay?
But we learned that other people are stepping up, even when their government is not. The Four Seasons Hotel in New York City, to cite one example, offered to open its 5-star accommodations to health workers, free of charge. We await an answering gesture from Trump Hotels. We learned that for the first time in their modern history, the Olympic Games will be held in an odd-numbered year, except that they won't, kind of. Though Tokyo bowed to the inevitable and agreed to postpone this summer's Games until next year, Tokyo Governor Yuriko Koike was quick to insist that the Games will still officially be called Tokyo 2020. 詳細についてはですね、例えば名称はそのまま東京2020でいくというお話でございました。An odd number is out of the question, she said, having possibly spoken to insurers concerned about how many owners of warehouses full of Tokyo 2020 t-shirts were planning a fire sometime this summer. Here's Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson on Wednesday's Globalist.
Corporate sponsors said, look, we've done logos over everything we've got for Tokyo 2020. The cost of doing that again is going to be astronomical. There's merchandise absolutely everywhere. We've got flags all over the city, all announcing Tokyo 2020.
We learned also of more trivial but much weirder conundrums created by a crisis which takes no interest in national borders or the different responses to COVID-19 on either side of them. The Low Countries village of Baarle is famously a bizarre patchwork of Dutch and Belgian territory, which inevitably means that some buildings have a border running through them. One such is the local branch of the Zeeman clothes store chain, which is doing its best to respect the different restrictions on activity prevailing in each country. So the bits of the shop in Belgium are closed, and the bits in the Netherlands are open. Prospective Dutch underwear purchasers are among those thwarted.
Dit is dus echt super absurd. Dat is de grens die door de winkel loopt. Die kant is open, want dat is Nederland. Deze kant is dicht, want dat is België.
Well, you work to earn a living, but on weekends comes the time. You can do whatever turns you on. Get out and clear your mind. Me, I like football, but there's a lot of things around. Line them up together, the footy wins hands down.
We learned indeed that we really are going to have to live without sport for however long this lasts. As noted in this space last week, the Australian Football League, the top flight competition of Australian rules football, had decided to start its 2020 season on schedule, possibly reasoning that any virus willing to risk the game's uncompromising hurly-burly was welcome to take its chances. However, the first weekend of matches wasn't even complete before league CEO Gillon McLachlan sounded the final siren.
Today, after a meeting with the AFL Commission, the AFL has moved to immediately suspend the 2020 Toyota AFL Premiership season at the conclusion of this weekend's matches.
We learned, however, that Australians, certainly Australian bookmakers, are a resourceful and adaptive bunch, as we all must be during this global emergency. With no sport to bet on, at least one Australian bookie has started taking bets on the weather. This punter has gone big on Hobart, clearing 19.2 degrees at 2 p.m. on Saturday. So if this item appears as scheduled next week, you can assume this wager didn't come in. We learned, however, that geopolitics as usual continues after a fashion. The European Union was, of course, recently reduced from 28 members to 27, though one now senses, what with one thing and another, that the UK's transition period could last a while longer than advertised. But the EU decided this week to clear the way to expanding to 29 countries, overcoming previous reservations about beginning membership negotiations with Albania and the country formerly known as the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, which is to say, North Macedonia. And on the basis that anything has to be worth a crack at this point, staff at Aachen Cathedral have gone rummaging in the crypt for the relics of what they claim is the patron saint of resisting epidemics. An amount of dispute has been cast upon this status by humorless theologians suggesting that a convenient narrative is being retrofitted, but they're on thin ice accusing others of inventing unlikely yarns to make everyone feel better, so let's run with it. The martyr in question was a young Syrian woman named Stephanie, who was bumped off by the Romans circa 177 AD. Her mortal remains were brought to Germany by the Holy Roman Emperor Otto III circa 997, and finally interred a little over a century ago in the gold, bronze, and ivory shrine that Aachen Cathedral's personnel are now polishing for public view. And we learned her post-canonization name, Saint Corona. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
And finally, we're going to stick with Andrew now. He's been working remotely this week, but that hasn't stopped him and Fernando from putting together one of our favourite features. Take it away, Chance.
Well, it is last thing on the briefing on Friday, which is traditionally when we do Fernando Augusto Pacheco's Global Countdown, when Fernando comes in with the top five from some or other country and attempts, usually unsuccessfully, to persuade me of the merits of the tracks therein. We are still doing it this week, clearly, but it's a little bit different, isn't it, Fernando? Because neither of us are actually at Midori House. Where are you?
We are in our lovely houses, actually. It's quite a sunny day here in London as well, which I thank very much this weather. But, you know, Global Countdown should never die, Andrew, you know, so we will keep doing this wherever we are.
Fernando, there are those that would argue that Global Countdown dies every week. I don't, but I agree with you. I don't see why we should stop just because of some pesky global pandemic. Let's get into it then. Where are we going this week?
Well, this week I had a think. You know, I decided to go for Italy. You know, they've been going through so much. They're the worst affected country when it comes to coronavirus. But at the same time, Andrew, music is so important to them as well. And I said, why not? Let's look what are Italians listening to it. And perhaps those songs can be a little bit a glimmer of hope. I know we can still make fun of some of the entries, and so you should, because, you know, there's some of them, they can be quite funny. But, you know,
let's go. Obviously, this goes out to all our listeners in Italy. We hope they're doing better soon. But at number 5 this week in Italy, we have
someone close to my heart, because he was the Italian entry for Eurovision last year. It's Mahmoud, the Italian-Egyptian singer, with his new single, Rapide. Shall we have a listen, Andrew?
Let's do that. Dimmi cosa c'è, le vedo scendere, sono rapide, chiuse nell'iride che scalerò, scalerò, scalerai, scalerò, come non lo so, dimmi te perché, mi vedo scendere. Sì. Fernando, I did research these tunes beforehand because, like a great many people, I have nothing better to do with my days anymore. But I did look at the video for this. Why is he sitting on a turtle? He's sitting on a very, very big turtle throughout the duration of that video.
He's very artistic, Andrew. That's all I can say. And that's why perhaps he didn't win Eurovision. I think he's quite a reserved guy. He likes to use some kind of very cool imagery. I thought I liked the turtle. I like his sitting in a turtle.
Okay, at number 4 then.
Number 4, God, the name of this band is so funny. I mean, it's Pinguini Tattici Nucleari. I mean, which if you translate to English, it's Nuclear Tactical Penguins. And the name of the song is even funnier, Ringo Starr. Ma questa sera ho solo voglia di ballare, di perdere la testa e non pensare più.
See, again, Fernando, because I have to find some way to fill the lonely hours at home, I did look up other songs which have been written down the years about Ringo Starr. And that one, I have to say, is no Ringo for President by the Young World Singers or Ringo I Love You by Cher.
Well, oh God, now you're playing with me. But I have to say, I mean, it's a very catchy refrain they have. I'm translating to English, but the main refrain of the song is, in a world of John and Paul, I'm Ringo Starr. Which is, it's a little bit sad, a little bit melancholic. But again, the band is doing so, so well in Italy. And I have to say this, they are from Bergamo, which is, again, one of the cities that has been more devastated about this crisis. So, of course, you know, they are posting all the time on their social media about the whole outbreak. So in a way, it's quite nice for them that they are in the charts. The song is doing very well. And they already have quite a lot of dates scheduled to perform in Italy later in the year. So, you know, if you're a fan of the band, don't worry. They will be back on stage very soon as well.
Okay, then. At number 3 in Italy this week.
Well, we have some, I can describe this as rap you can dance to. It's we have Italian rapper Gali with another Italian rapper called Salmo. The song is Boogeyman. And I have to say, I quite enjoy the beat of that one. Shall we listen to it?
Okay. Che lei si bagna più di me. Poi faccio cose stupide, stupide. Ma non è cool. Yeah, Fernando, are they playing that one from loudspeakers on police vans to keep people inside?
Exactly. Well, and they're maintaining the same trend which we spoke a few weeks ago, that sample of 90s dance hits. I think that's a massive trend in 2020. I personally welcome that trend.
Okay, at number 2, and I do know in advance that there's a bit of a recurring theme here.
Absolutely, we have Gali again. But this song, a little bit of different in tone, actually is a very positive track. Let's listen to it. It's called Good Times, and I'll tell you
why is it so positive?
Okay.
Bella atmosfera. Ti prego non uccidere il mood.
Well, that was Good Times by Gali. Fernando, I believe you were about to give us some extra context.
Absolutely. I mean, the video clip for the song actually was released, you know, just a day ago, and was recorded with all of his fans on Instagram, mostly in their homes, you know, just singing and dancing. So he did that because, you know, everybody, you know, is working from home or is in quarantine. So it's kind of a song for good times, you know. You can still be with your family, dancing. It's a song about positivity, and I think Italians are very much clinging to that. So I thought it was a very sweet video. Usually, perhaps in normal circumstances, we could make fun of those videos, but it's something quite nice, I would say.
But there is an interesting question here, I think, which is it's very early days yet, and we don't know how pop music is going to respond to a world under siege like this. This is something entirely new. Do you anticipate, though, that we're going to see, especially in Italy, whose pop tradition is kind of renowned for being somewhat upbeat, an even more upbeat version of it? Should we be braced for the Sabrina comeback?
Oh my God, that would be my dream. But you're very right. In times of difficulties, I mean, people do like to escape, you know, not only music-wise, but film-wise and, you know, and everything, you know. So, yeah, maybe you're right. And to be honest, our number one song, yeah, I would call it a little bit of an escapist song. And there's one record here for this, for the number one song, actually. It's the youngest Italian artist to be at number one on the charts.
Okay, then introduce, Fernando, if you would, this week's Italian number one is...
It's Italian rapper Anna with the incredibly catchy Bando.
Okay, number one in Italy, that is Anna. That is the end of this week's Global Countdown. Fernando, shall I see you in roughly the same time next week? Shall we try doing this from other rooms?
Let's try that. I really want you to do it in your garden, because I know you have great plants in your garden. You show me some pictures. I like it.
I'll give that some thought. I mean, it's pretty quiet outdoors at the moment in London, so we might get away with that. For the moment, however, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And my thanks to both Andrew and Fernando. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James and Daniel Bage. It was researched by Charlie Fielmacourt, and our studio manager was Nora Hewell. The Briefing is back on Monday at the same time. Meanwhile, do keep across with Monocle's agenda. Stay tuned or sign up for our daily email bulletins from our team all around the world. And don't forget, if you are stuck indoors at the moment, that Monocle can come to you in print. We have some new subscription offers which you can also unlock at the website. I am Markus Hippi. Thanks for listening and goodbye.